building a wall between friends, a wall that justifies any means for their ends, a wall between Semites, rich and poor, brothers and sisters, from not so long before, many feet thick and 20 feet high, no one can look through it and into the eye of a person you might know, to whom you might confide, now just a stranger on the other side. They're building a wall between water and land, so we can eat fruit and they can eat sand. A wall to make sure that our orchards will grow and our kids can get fat and not need to know of the cities in ruins and the children in fear that your fathers and brothers in tanks might be near. A wall to keep quiet that which you fear most, so you don't have to listen to your grandfather's ghost. They're building a wall between future and past, a wall to keep distant the chambers of gas from the bulldozers' gunships and the tears of a child. Dignity, love, and honor defiled, to remove reality from your facts on the ground. A wall to keep distance the terrible sound of the houses that crumble and the children that die. A wall to keep separate the truth from the lie. They're building a wall, and at such a cost, land, money, and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken and said, no more walls, no more refugees, no more keeping people upon their knees. And then the history books will someday recall, before apartheid was ended, they were building a wall.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice, and you can hear us at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. If you're just joining us, you're listening to How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country with Andrew Basevich.
At the beginning of the introduction, you talk about a Captain William Reichert. What's that story?
Well, Reichert was a member of the Class 68 from West Point. And when I got to 1st Squadron, 10th Cavalry, he was a troop commander. I was not in, he was a troop commander of C Troop, and I was in D Troop. And I did not know him well. I had not known him at all until I showed up at On K. But over the course of my tour, he was murdered. He was murdered by an American soldier assigned to the 1st Squadron, 10th Cavalry. And this was at the time a shocking episode, an eye-opening episode, and one of the aspects of my Vietnam experience that stuck with me. And I had wanted for some time to, however briefly, tell his story, because I think the story is an important one, and I think that his murder by an American soldier shouldn't be forgotten. And the event is, to some degree, emblematic of the times. And so that's something that I included in the introduction.
But how did he get murdered by an American? And is it murder or was it a mistake?
No, it was murder. The perpetrator had words with Captain Reichert. And I believe, I can't say this for sure, the words had to do with allegations that the perpetrator was involved in a barracks theft. This is...
Enlisted man?
Yes, a private. I think helicopter mechanic.
Malloyer or something like that? The name of the
Moyler.
Moyler.
Yeah, Moyler. Broad daylight on the firebase, meaning not on patrol, but Moyler had his M16, and he shot and he killed Reichert in front of Reichert's orderly room. Now, Moyler was immediately detained, arrested, charged, convicted, sent to prison, never heard of again. I tried to find out what happened to him. I was unable to do so. Reichert disappeared. His remains were removed, and things more or less went back to normal.
Any publicity on this at the time, and how did you remember this?
Virtually none. One of the things I did for the book is to go back and check Stars and Stripes. You know, Stars and Stripes is this newspaper that's been published for deployed forces ever since World War II. And during the Vietnam War, there was a European edition of Stars and Stripes for people in Germany and Europe, and there was a specific edition of Stars and Stripes. So I went and checked the Pacific edition of Stars and Stripes to find out how this shocking event was reported, and the answer, it was barely reported. There was like one short article mentioning this attack, providing minimal detail, other than, I found very interesting, making a brief reference to other attacks by enlisted soldiers on officers that had also happened very recently in Vietnam. So it's not that the attack on Captain Reichert was a one-off event. Rather, it was indicative of the deterioration of order and discipline that afflicted the Army in Vietnam at that time.
I want to run a piece of video of President Obama a couple years ago at a State of the Union message saying some things about the condition of our country and then get your reaction to it.
Okay.
America is back. Anyone who tells you otherwise, anyone who tells you that America is in decline or that our influence has waned, doesn't know what they're talking about. Yes, the world is changing. No, we can't control every event. But America remains the one indispensable nation in world affairs, and as long as I'm president, I intend to keep it that way.
What's your take on that?
Well, you'd like to be able to peer into the president's heart and soul and know if he really meant those words. He was saying what he has to say. He is saying what an American president is expected to say, making claims of our uniqueness that have become very commonplace in our politics. It's striking, of course, is his use of the phrase indispensable nation, first coined by Madeleine Albright back when she was Secretary of State and embraced by Bill Clinton when he became president. And it's to make the claim at the present moment, I think, is to, in effect, say that there is no need for us to think seriously about the implications of our failures over the past decade, in particular our foreign policy and national security failures. And I'm referring here to specifically to the Iraq War, but also by extension to the Afghanistan War. President's giving Americans, or his listeners at least, permission to forget all that and to pretend that they didn't happen.
After you saw what was going on in Vietnam, which was early in your career, why did you make a career out of the Army?
In some respects, because I didn't have the gumption to get out. I had gotten married right before I deployed, probably foolishly. By the time my obligation, the obligation that I incurred by graduating from West Point, by the time my obligation was up, we had two children, two little kids, and the economy was a little bit soft. And I don't think I had the self-confidence at the time to say, well, I can go do something different, and I can make enough money to care for my family. And at the same time, the Army, in its infinite wisdom, offered me the opportunity to go to graduate school. They said, well, you know, look, we'll send you to graduate school, and then you can go teach at West Point for a while. And, you know, that was going to take up the next chunk of years, and it was going to be a set of years when I would know that we were going to have a paycheck coming in. And by the time we got to the end of that next chunk of years, so now we're like at the 10-year mark of my service. My son had been born, so now we had three kids. And we seriously thought of getting out and then backed away from it. And, you know, life moves on and we have four kids. So it was only in the early 1990s that I finally came to the realization that I truly was not cut out to be a soldier in the first place. And that my wife, who I love dearly, basically at that point said, look, she'd never cared to be in the Army anyway, and made it pretty clear. We agreed, I should say, we agreed that it was time to move on. And so,
hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes Great Speeches and Interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook. Coming up next, Charles Coughlin, a controversial Roman Catholic priest at Royal Oak, Michigan's National Shrine of the Little Flower Church. He denounces the New Deal and Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s.
And therefore, choosing right instead of might, choosing to be on the side of justice instead of on the side of modern capitalism, with its intermingling with socialism and communism, I stand before you tonight to warn you, careless of what the future holds to me, that this relief that has failed to relieve, by pounding up its taxation, by doubling its assessment upon the payrolls of the nation, by finding its way into the grocer shops where you purchase your food, this relief that lives upon a sucker's taking from the people every penny they own, is due to crumble and fall before 1 year from this April. You think you know what depression is? You people living on the WPA envelopes. WPA envelopes filled partly from the money confiscated from industry and commerce and from the envelopes of those who are working. How long can that last? It can't last forever. There's no bottomless pit to that spending. You WPA workers and those of you who are living upon the dole system, how long can it last for this Federal Reserve Bank to invent and coin and issue its own bogus money against the debts of a nation, and then when the bond market drops as it's dropping now, print more fresh $5 bills to buy in its own bonds? Oh, there's a law of compensation, and there's an accounting to be held, an accounting that shall make the depression of 1929 seem as a prosperity when it breaks upon you. What sins we have committed. When the Bill of Rights was established in England, it insisted that the spending power be held in the hands of the people. It insisted that the spending power of a nation be held in the hands of its parliament or its Congress. View the New Deal in 1933 and 34. Did it revere the Bill of Rights for which men had bled and died? Oh, no. It took the Bill of Rights as it's taking our Constitution today and tore it into shreds and handed over the spending power from the purse of the people, from the purse of Congress, to the President of the United States, one step backward, one step towards dictatorship. That may seem peculiar to you, but in doing that, Congress relinquished its own liberty and relinquished its own freedom of speech. Since that day, since the chief executive of the nation has the full spending power of billions of dollars, Congress must bend its pregnant knee before him. Congress must become a rubber stamp Congress, or else be rubbed out of existence in the line of patronage. All patronage, all partyism, save us from those things. We who once loved patriotism, we who once loved democracy, we who once proudly raised our heads, favoring justice with a heel upon us, ready to spawn and crush every inch.
And now, back to How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country with Andrew Basevit.
Here's another clip from former Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld from the other side of the political fence. Tell us what you see here.
If you do not have standing task force capable of assuring you that in a very short period of time you can get into business in the event you need to be in business, you have substantially reduced the president's options. Conversely, if you do have it ready to go, capable of doing things, you may not only substantially increase the president's options, but you may very well provide options in the pre-war period, in the crisis period, that enables you to substantially affect the deterrent in a way that dissuades somebody from doing something that could cause that conflict.
Well, I think the phrase that he used that struck me most is he talked about these standing task forces doing things. Well, doing what? Now, in 2003, at the time that the Iraq War began, if we'd been able to say to Rumsfeld, "Mr. Secretary, what do you mean by doing things?" he probably would have said something to the effect that, "Well, I say doing things, I mean winning things." That there was an expectation that really emerged in the aftermath of Desert Storm back in 1991, seemingly confirmed by the early success in Afghanistan in 2001, that had created a very powerful expectation by 2003 that when we committed U.S. forces into combat, they're going to win. They're going to win quickly. They're going to win decisively. They're going to win economically. I mean, economically, both in terms of dollar cost and in terms of the sacrifices that would be imposed on U.S. forces. Now, were that in fact to, were those expectations to be valid, then sign me up. Sign me up. Give me some of those standing task forces that we can deploy when we, giving the president options, perhaps as Rumsfeld's suggesting, the knowledge of our adversaries that we can do this perhaps is going to cause them to think again. So if you can guarantee me a victory, sign me up. What's the problem? The problem is we tested that proposition in Iraq, and it turned out to be not the case. And indeed, despite the early evidence of success in Afghanistan, Afghanistan also turns out to be a case that doesn't demonstrate that we can win victories. When the president in the earlier clip is talking about we're the indispensable nation, and what he doesn't want us to talk about, what does he want Americans to contemplate? What he doesn't want Americans to contemplate is we don't know how to win wars. We have, by virtually any measure, the best military in the world. We certainly spend more on our military than basically the rest of the world put together. But we don't know how to win wars. And it seems to me that there really ought to be a very serious national conversation to ask, why is that the case? Where is the fault lie? Is it our politicians are too stupid? Is it our generals are inept? Is it the size of the forces are too small? Or is it, and this is my belief, is it the fact that by its very nature, war is unpredictable? To go to war is to roll the dice. And you might win and you might not. And if you view war as simply rolling the dice, well then, again, and this is what I think conservatives should believe, then you only should do this when it's absolutely necessary. And you need to go in with your eyes wide open because it's not going to go the way you think it's going to go.
You write about the following in your book, but this was back in 2004. General Eric Shinseki at the time, I believe he was head of the Army.
He was Chief of Staff of the Army.
Chief of Staff of the Army, who he's now head of the Veterans Administration in the Obama administration. Yeah. But here's what he said at a hearing. And shortly after that, he went away for a long time. We didn't have any idea of a follow-up. He didn't talk about this, but let's watch this.
Could you give us some ideas to the magnitude of the Army's force requirement for an occupation of Iraq following a successful completion of the war?
In specific numbers, I would have to rely on combatant commanders' exact requirements, but I think...
How about a range?
I would say that what's been mobilized to this point, something on the order of several hundred thousand soldiers are probably a figure that would be required. We're talking about post-hostilities, control over a piece of geography that's fairly significant with the kinds of ethnic tensions that could lead to other problems. And so it takes a significant ground force presence.
In footnote 55 in your chapter 6, you say Paul Wolfowitz dismissed Shinseki's concerns as, quote, wildly off the mark, unquote, remarking, by the way, of a rebuttal that, quote, it's hard to conceive that it would take more forces to provide stability in post-Saddam Iraq than it would to conduct the war itself and to secure the surrender of Saddam's security forces and his army. What's this all? What happened to General Shinseki after that?
Well, Shinseki basically was silenced. And the episode, of course, is a very famous one. It's famous in part because events vindicated Shinseki and made Mr. Wolfowitz look like a bit of a fool. But I think what's important about the episode, to appreciate the importance of the episode, you have to appreciate, in a sense, the ideological context in which this debate, let's call it the Shinseki-Wolfowitz debate, the ideological context in which the debate occurs. And the ideological context has two dimensions. The first dimension is that Wolfowitz came from a political camp, generally referred to as the neoconservatives, who were committed to the proposition that the United States possessed the capacity to export democracy and that nations living under autocrats like Saddam Hussein yearned to be liberated and to embrace democracy, and that therefore this our capacity and their yearning would combine to make this transition to democracy relatively neat and easy. And Shinseki is saying, ain't going to happen that way. So that's one reason why Wolfowitz would go after Shinseki. But there's a second reason, relating to a theory of war that also had come to be something of an ideology at this time. And the theory of war was one that basically said that advanced information technology, or forces equipped with advanced information technology, an ability to identify targets, to strike targets with great precision, to act with great speed, that the forces possessing these abilities would be able to win wars decisively and quickly, and as I suggested a little while ago, sort of neatly and economically. And the Iraq War was a full-scale test of that proposition. And here we are on the eve of the Iraq War, and Shinseki is saying, from an army perspective, I ain't buying that. I think it's going to be complicated and messy. So for both of those reasons, both the sort of the neoconservative commitment to the notion that we can export democracy and this other notion that high-tech U.S. forces are going to be able to win quickly, he had gone way out of bounds.
I want to make sure that I correct what I said. I said 2004. It was the 2004 defense budget, but he made that statement on February the 25th, 2003, right
correct.
Before the March.
That's correct. Before the invasion. That's correct.
You write in your book about a famous name in history, in military history, Lieutenant General Smedley Butler.
Major General Smedley Butler.
Excuse me. I gave him another stripe. Major General Smedley Butler. Who was he and why did you write about him?
Well, he's a fantastic character. He was a Marine. He was a Marine who served basically from the beginning of the first outward thrust of American empire, the Spanish-American War and its aftermath, served through the into the 1930s, twice won the Medal of Honor. Although he participated in World War I, his role in World War I was not really significant. The real sort of fabric of Smedley Butler's career was in policing the American empire, participating in the Boxer expedition in China, invading and occupying various Caribbean islands, the Dominican Republic and Haiti, an instrument of U.S. foreign policy. And he was good at it. But what makes him of such great interest to historians is that virtually the day after he took off his uniform and became a civilian, he publicly announced that all of that service, actually he'd been a gangster. I think the phrase is a gangster in service of capitalism. That he said out loud what critics of American foreign policy had been saying throughout this period, that U.S. foreign policy basically exists to serve the interests of Wall Street. So he became a controversial truth teller in his way and is fondly remembered by anti-war people in this country down to the present moment.
He got off the plane, looked at no one, walked down the tarmac in the direction of nowhere, followed the sun as it was setting, glad to be done with all the bloodletting. There were no banners for the proud and the few, just workers in airports that do what they do. Fuel up the planes, unload the bags, along with the coffins all covered in flags. When Johnny came marching home, the town he was from was a dead little place, so he looked for a job somewhere off base. In the city of pawn shops, hotels and bars, gas stations, strip clubs, highways and cars, he went to a dive, ordered a beer, so turn the music up loud, so it's all that I hear. Try to rewind, turn back the years, stop the explosions between my ears. When Johnny came marching home, well, the jobs were all shit, and the beer was cheap, Besides, there was no other way he could sleep. Still, the screams and the guns would wake him at night. He was always on edge and ready to fight. When he closed his eyes, he would just see the face of a woman he killed in some faraway place. Over and over, the white of her eye and her final, terrible, terrified cry. When Johnny came marching back. Joints and a thump in the heart. The doctor just told him it's all in his head, but he couldn't stop drinking or get out of bed. And with no place to go but the wrong way, it was a shock to his ears when he heard himself say over and over to anyone within range, "Hey mister, can you spare some change?" When Johnny came marching.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.